Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken? A podcast from Questrom School of Business. Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode, a conversation with Dean Susan Fournier, where she answers the question at the heart of the show.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. So right after we wrap up this show every day, it's snack time for me. And every day, I reach for a bag of almonds that sits on my desk. You know, healthy oils and all that. And yeah, the almonds come in a plastic bag, like just about everything does. Well, little did I know that my almond habit was going to show up in what we call a pre-interview. Now, these are conversations that our producers, in this case, producer Steph Katsonis, have with guests prior to the show. Steph was talking with Erica Serino, and they were talking about microplastics. Specifically, when I'm tearing into that bag of my beloved almonds, or when you're eating a bag of chips, are we eating way more than the actual food itself?
Scientists have even created resources showing like how to open a bag of chips so you minimize the microplastics going in. It's like it's gotten to that point.
Wow.
So, yeah.
Is there a demonstration of this with somebody talking I can find on a YouTube thing?
Let me see.
I'm laughing you say the chip bag because just yesterday we were trying to talk about how to structure the show. The host had a bag of almonds and it's like, oh, you mean I'm eating
right.
plastic here too?
Right, right. It's unbelievable, isn't it?
Well, Erica Serino is author of Thicker Than Water, The Quest for Solutions to the Plastic Crisis. And yes, it is unbelievable, or actually more unsettling, really, because there's been an overwhelming amount of evidence for a long time that microplastics are having a deleterious impact on the Earth's oceans and the life within it, and that plastics can be found just about everywhere on the planet, no matter how remote. Now, there's new evidence that microplastics might also be found inside of you. Because scientists have confirmed the presence of microplastics in living human beings, in their blood, and deep in lung tissue. So how did they get there? And are they a problem? Well, Erica Serino is with us now for the official show, not the pre-interview. And again, she's author of Thicker Than Water, The Quest for Solutions to the Plastic Crisis. Erica, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Meghna. Thanks for having me today.
So, I'm not going to give up my almond habit first and foremost, but I do want to actually get a sense, before we talk about the human health implications here, about two things. First, is there anywhere on Earth, from the planet's highest peaks to the ocean's deepest trenches, where there isn't evidence of some kind of human-made plastics?
It seems like there is no place that has escaped our plastic scourge, and that's based off of a huge amount of science that's still growing and a vast research network of scientists and individuals from communities who are concerned about the extent of plastic all around us. And there's plastic virtually everywhere that we look, and new research tools have enabled that new understanding to develop over the past 5 to 10 years or so.
So just to be clear, like I'll just pick not the deepest, but one of the deepest trenches I know, like the Mariana Trench. Has there been evidence of microplastics found there?
Yes, and even famously intact plastic items at the bottom of the trench. And this is a place, for those who may not know, about 7 miles below sea level, the very deepest part of our ocean. And that's very far away from any people. So how does the plastic get there? I think it was the big question.
Mm-hmm. And then similarly, even in deserts or high mountain areas, the highest mountains in the world, we know that there's plastics up there because people are porting them up there. But also like microplastics as well?
So the thing that we need to know about plastic is that they never break down like benignly like biodegradable materials, but instead they break up into these tiny pieces that scientists tend to refer to as microplastic. If you take a look at the pinky nail on your hand, that's about the size of a microplastic particle at the larger size range, but they can go down to below 5 millimeters, and that's classified as like a microplastic. So these are small pieces of plastic. Scientists have likened them to confetti. there's an even smaller range called nanoplastic that is, you know, so small that sometimes we can't even see these particles. And so it's still plastic. And so because these particles are so tiny, they're so easily transported by the wind and the waves and different biogeochemical systems on Earth. And so they do become a part of our, you know, atmospheric climate and weather, and they're found throughout our waterways and oceans and soils as well. So it's an unbelievable issue and only growing larger as we create more plastic.
So plastics, or micro or nanoplastics, are becoming part of the weather even. That is incredible. Okay, so Erica, let's start at the very beginning of the process here, because I do think it actually behooves us, before we talk about the human health implications, to understand, like, how is it that these things are created, broken down, but then remain ubiquitous? So most plastics start with some kind of petrochemical, right?
Sure, yeah. So you need gas or oil to make plastic, although increasingly coal is being used to create plastic now as we shift away from using coal for forms of energy.
So, how do we turn coal into plastics?
There's a process. It's being mostly used in China to produce kind of like very heavy, often like wood-like material out of plastic, and it's like a compressed type of coal. And I could go into that process, but it essentially turns coal into a type of polymer. But without getting too deep into the chemistry of it, I'll just say basically you need some sort of fossil fuel source to make what we know as conventional plastic. The first plastics were actually made from plants mixed with all different types of what we would consider toxins like asbestos. So, you know, the earliest plastics before petrochemical plastics weren't great either. We need to acknowledge that. But these materials were seen as something that were you know, readily available, inexpensive, and following World War II, when a lot of plastics were used, you know, in the war effort, synthetic plastic was first synthesized in the early 1900s. Bakelite was famously, you know, the first kind of petrochemical phenol-based plastic. And from there, you know, plastics evolved. And in the 1940s and 1950s, we really saw a boom in plastics production, especially in the United States, but also in Europe. And from there, plastic spread around the world.
I mean, they're literally everywhere.
Yes.
Literally everywhere. I mean, every time we talk about plastics on this show, the first thing I do is I look around our studio, and every single surface that I can see is either plastic or has a plastic component in it, right? Even the table that I'm using, it's wood and some kind of particle board, but I'm sure there are plastics in the particle board as well. What about clothing?
That's a big one. Much of our clothing is made of plastic. And when you find clothing that's inexpensive and it seems like a steal, you know, you got a deal on something, it's often because that piece of clothing was made in very poor working. People were working in very poor conditions making that piece of clothing, first of all. And then second of all, it's probably made out of plastic. And so there is kind of this ethical conundrum as well associated with plastic, because, you know, it is driving other issues too. And I'm sure we'll get more into that in a bit. But to stick to, you know, what is the ubiquity of it? It's in our clothing. It's in our furniture. It's in our building materials, our foodware, our food packaging, you know, accessories. I mean, I'm just looking around the studio now too and just noticing things. So I'll stop there. But yeah. We get the picture.
Yeah, and I mean, they're used in places where that we would otherwise also consider to be sterile, like medical grade plastics. But they're plastics. They're made. They're used in food production, let alone food storage and transportation, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, it's one of my other favorite sort of scary. I don't want to say scary, but eye opening examples is even just the plastics that are used when cows are milked. Right, there are pipes in which the milk travels through. So the question is, first of all, is the breakdown of these plastics from the, you know, the surfaces or packaging that we are familiar with, what's the process of the breakdown into becoming micro or nanoplastics?
Yeah, let's talk about that. And so plastic stuff is not just like this non-moving, you know, non-changing thing. It is a dynamic thing, and the polymer bonds in plastic can break, but they do not easily break plastic down into its more simple components. Instead, it's just going to be pieces of plastic. So how does that happen? Exposure to sunlight, for example, UV rays can break down certain types of plastics. And so they are breaking up into these particles when there's also heat applied. In the oceans, for example, the wind and the waves and the churning of the seas contributes to that breakup. Wind and rain, you know, there are so many different ways that plastics are kind of sloughed off into these various particles, these nanoplastic and microplastic particles. And for our clothing, you know, we could throw a plastic-based piece of clothing in the washing machine and tens of thousands of particles will come off of that one item. So it really is happening, but it's on a scale that's so small that, you know, like the almond bag or the chips bag, we can't see it. But when we're opening all of the food that we eat, essentially, that's wrapped in plastic, there are particles going into it, and we kind of need to understand that that's happening. And I don't want to be an alarmist.
My heart is sinking.
I know, I'm sorry, and I'm just trying to be realistic, but it's true, and we need to all agree on, like, that this is happening. It is a crazy thing to think about, but yeah.
Yeah. Well, so, I mean, we will discuss, we'll think through later in the show about, you know, you're right. Like, we don't want to be alarmist, but we want to sort of explore with open eyes what the potential implications are. So we'll do that a little bit later. But Erica, it does sound like what you're describing is like, if I had a bionic eye, right? And right. I like had a filter, which I could put on my bionic eye that would like visualize the micro right. and nanoplastics in our environment. It sounds like I'd effectively see a world in which I'm swimming through micro or nanoplastics almost all the time.
Truly, yes. it's even in our air. One of the most eye-opening studies that I encountered were a few researchers in Denmark who were studying the prevalence of microplastic and nanoplastic particles in our air. And they found that we breathe in about 11 particles of plastic per hour inside our homes. So, startling stuff.
Well, we'll hear more about that research and specifically the new findings about how those microplastics and nanoplastics are getting into people's lungs, into their bloodstreams. The first ever confirmation that these plastics are indeed in living human beings. So that's what we'll talk about when we come back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/onpoint. That's Indeed.com/onpoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. These days, it's hard to ignore the debate over the role business should play in society.
There's crescendo around profit, period. Is profit bad? Is capitalism evil? These themes are out there.
Is this criticism of business warranted? And if so, how do we fix it? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode of the Is Business Broken podcast.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and today we are talking about micro and nanoplastics and recent studies, new studies, that have found evidence of those micro and nanoplastics inside living human bodies. I'm joined today by Erica Serino. She's author of Thicker Than Water, The Quest for Solutions to the Plastic Crisis. And we have an excerpt of her book at onpointradio.org. And before the break, Erica talked about a study in Denmark that found evidence of microplastics in the air inside people's homes. Well, Alvisa Vianenlo is the researcher at the Aalborg University in Denmark who did some of this work, and he and his colleagues wanted to study how many microplastics people breathe in their homes in one 24-hour period. So they tested three apartments using a so-called breathing thermal mannequin.
the device is breathing, and therefore it's possible to filter the air that is breathed, and the filters are then analyzed. And what we found is the ubiquitous presence of microplastic particles in 3 apartments, where the concentration was varying between 1.7 and 16.2 particles per cubic meter of air inhaled. This basically means that we can breathe around up to 200 particles of microplastic in 24 hours.
That's Elvisa Vianello in Denmark. Well, joining us now from Amsterdam in the Netherlands is Heather Leslie. She's established the Microplastics Lab at the Free University of Amsterdam. Heather, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much.
So you and your team have also found evidence of micro and nanoplastics in living human bodies. Where did you find them?
Yes, we looked in the human bloodstream and we found out that micro and nanoplastics are actually very close to our hearts. We expected that plastics would be circulating in our bodies, but now we know they are. We have the first evidence for that.
How did you find it?
It took a lot of trial and error to develop a method that's sensitive enough. And of course, as you just like your studio, our lab has a lot of plastic in it. And we have to be extremely careful about the quality control of the analysis. I think this was the most difficult analysis I've ever tried in my entire career. And so it took us a long time to get our analysis sensitive enough and to make sure we weren't introducing any background contamination in from our lab or from all the stuff that we use in order to do the analysis.
Oh, Heather, you know, in the reading and thinking that we've been doing about this hour, I have to admit, it didn't even occur to me the high chance of cross-contamination because of the ubiquity of plastics, even just in scientific laboratory equipment. Wow. Okay, but you overcame that challenge and were able to come up with some kind of assay that detected these micro and nanoplastics in blood samples. What kind of, like, where did you get the samples from? Obviously, we don't have to identify the individual people, but were these just from, where do they come from?
Yeah, so we had 22 anonymous donors that our university also has a university hospital. So I worked together with an immunologist and doctor there, and we were able to access these samples from there. It was a little bit difficult because we were doing that during the first lockdowns, and the immunologists were working on COVID research, and this had a little bit less priority at the time. But we managed to finish up our short 1-year pilot project, which had, of course, a lot of work done before that, before we were ready for the samples. But yeah, we were ready for the samples, and we managed to do 22 people, which gives us a good indication of concentration ranges to expect and to see if we could find anything at all. Because really, you know, if you find something in the air or in the food chain, that tells you a lot about what we are encountering, but mm-hmm. it doesn't tell you what's being absorbed in your body.
Right.
And so by looking in the bloodstream, you're actually doing that extra step to find out what is the absorbable fraction.
Okay, so we're going to talk about what you actually found in the blood in a second here, but can you, mm-hmm. were the samples from adults, or was there a range of ages?
Oh, yes. They were all adults over
adults.
18.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Because we're going to want to talk about the impact on children a little bit later, or maybe what questions we should ask to understand what the potential impact on kids can be. Okay. So did you find what concentrations of micro and nanoplastics did you find in these blood samples?
Yeah. So we were finding, plastic is a whole range of different substances, let's say. So we looked at, with our method, we weren't looking at counting the particles like some other studies, but we were actually measuring the mass of each type of plastic individually. So we found things like PET, which is you make water bottles out of, and polystyrene, a type of polymers, and polyethylene, and these kinds of plastics. And some people are just interested in the whole sum of all the plastics. So we also, in our article, reported the sum. And when you add up all the plastics that we find in one sample, we came to an average of 1.6 micrograms in a milliliter of blood. And that sounds like a very small amount, but if that blood sample is representative for the whole body, then we're talking milligrams in a single human body just circulating in the bloodstream at the time that we were sampling.
I'm trying to think of what a visual equivalent of a milligram would be, like a quarter teaspoon or something. Maybe that's still too much.
Oh, it's very, very, very small. Mm. Yeah, you can't see. Plastic is very light, you know, it's not a very heavy material. Mm. So a microgram, it's like around a microgram in a milliliter of blood, like a milliliter of blood, that's, I think there's 15 milliliters in a teaspoon, something like that. So it's a small amount of blood, but it's also a very small amount of plastic in the blood.
Okay. So, Erica Serino, what's your thoughts when you first heard about Heather and her team's research essentially confirming that there are, even if a small amount, discernibly different types of micro and nanoplastics circulating in living human bodies?
Well, like most people, probably my first reaction was, oh, no. But I also know in the context of the research I did, when writing my book, Thicker Than Water, to tell the story of the plastic crisis, that actually research showing plastics and plastic particles in our environment were published as early as the 1960s and 1970s. And recently, you know, this research has kind of accelerated, and there's been a push to look inside the human body. And finally, we're getting there, and research is evolving rapidly now. But there has been a long understanding, I think, in the scientific community that plastic exists all around us on Earth. But the ubiquity and the true understanding that we live in a time where actually we change the geological nature of our planet and are living in a plasticine of sorts is not surprising to know that, you know, we are also becoming plastic.
Wow. Well, Heather, this actually links back to why finding it in the blood is particularly eye-opening, because blood is everywhere in the human body. It has, as you've said before, it's the river of life. Its purpose is transport, right? To transport nutrients, oxygen to every cell in the body, to transport waste away from those cells. So does this mean that essentially every part of the human body, Heather, is being exposed, even if it's to a small amount of these, is being exposed to these micro and nanoplastics?
Yes, this is why I really wanted to focus on blood in the first place. You know, there have been some studies about feces, and I was thinking, well, that's more of a problem for the sewage treatment plants, you know, and it's going right through our bodies. But the blood, if it's absorbed into the blood, as you said just now, the blood bathes all of our cells of our body, and it needs to do that on a very regular basis. And so anything that is in our bloodstream can reach our organs. And in toxicology, we're interested in what gets close to what we call sites of toxic action. So if it's outside your body, it's not interacting with the biology. But when it's inside your body and it gets close to some area of your body that's doing its thing, that's functioning as it normally does in nature, then you can have an opportunity to cause toxicity. If that particle knows how to cause toxicity, it needs to be close to that close to that area where it can cause the damage. So that's why it's important to look at blood.
Right. Okay. So because there we have basically an exposure pathway, right, to every organ system, every system in the human body through blood. But, you know, on the other hand, of course, everyone wants to know, like, oh my gosh, so what impact does this have on human health? And we don't have the answers to those questions yet, right? Because the research is still very new in confirming the presence of plastics inside living bodies. But I am thinking, you know, in modern life, we're exposed to a lot of things every day. We breathe them in, we eat them in. And I'm not saying that they're inert, but perhaps they are absorbed into our bodies at such low levels that it doesn't actually cause some kind of deleterious effect on human health. Could that be possible, Heather?
Go ahead. I always say we have to not really jump the gun and claim that it's safe or it's not safe. We should just say we don't know until we collect enough evidence to make those kinds of claims. So it's a very difficult situation to be in to say, I don't know, because everybody wants an answer. We do have half of the answer because our risk to human health is built up about from the exposure and from knowledge about which exposure level is sort of a threshold for the toxicity. So above a certain level, you can expect toxicity. Below a certain level, you don't expect it. It's like the very, very 500-year-old knowledge that the dose makes the poison. So the most important part to know is there any poison there or potential poison? And we know that if the dose gets high enough, we probably will see effects, even if it's table salt or even if you drink too much water. So there is a certain point where it will be toxic. So it's very important to know what the dose is. And there's a lot of research going on now. And I think one of the main areas to really look at is the immunotoxicological side. So what effect does this have on our immune systems? And I think that's a good place to really look.
Mm. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point. We're getting lots of comments here from folks listening. Renee Shapiro says, 1 microgram per mil of blood sounds pretty high, given the toxicity and potential havoc it could produce adhering to cells. Erica Serino, I wonder, so the research on the impact on living human bodies, relatively new, well, actually very new in the span of science here. But we've known, as you pointed out and have written extensively in your book, that these micro nanoplastics have been in the environment for a long time already. So is there research on the impacts they've had, or what does the research say on the impacts they've had on non-human organisms, all those the animals living, you know, in the seas that we talk about, where it's basically snowing microplastics all the time?
Right. So microplastics have profound effects on non-human wildlife and ecosystems that both humans and non-humans need to survive. And in the oceans, there are a lot of like very huge effects that this microplastic is having, most notably scientists being concerned about the ocean carbon cycle, the ability of plankton to help sequester carbon that we release into the atmosphere, and which we are having a very big problem with at the moment. And it's a problem to which plastics are intrinsically related because their production, use, and disposal produces huge amounts of greenhouse gases. So we have to acknowledge that. But in terms of the effects on non-human wildlife, we're seeing things such as, you know, physical blockages, for example. If small creatures might be entangled in plastic, for example, plankton, maybe swimming into a plastic fiber from our clothing, or whales eating, you know, tens of thousands of plastic particles when they gulp down their food. Filter feeding animals can't control whether or not they take it in. And some of these plastic particles are also delivering toxins. Plastics are made with an assortment of 10,000 plus chemicals, and thousands of them are already considered hazardous or potentially hazardous. And we're talking about things like BPA, phthalates, and PFAS, which are all endocrine disrupting or hormone disrupting chemicals. And in wildlife, the chemical effects are more well understood than in humans at this moment. But there's inklings that, you know, this plastic is capable of traveling to the brain and causing health and physical behavioral abnormalities in fish, for example, that impair survival. So there's huge implications, you know, to the point where wildlife are either being sickened, physically handicapped, or kind of just dying off. So it's a lot of huge effects that could occur.
Mm. Heather Leslie, Erica mentioned potential travel into the brain in fish. That makes me think in human bodies, there are certain places where we've just presumed that there are natural barriers, blood-brain barrier, the placental barrier. Do we know if these microplastics are crossing those barriers in people?
Yeah. So way back in 2010, I came across an article of somebody who had taken a placenta after a child's birth, and you can do a study to see if contaminants can cross this placental barrier. And they actually did show that little tiny nano-sized particles of polystyrene were going across this placenta. And especially at the end of the pregnancy, I've understood that the placenta is pretty stretched or permeable at that point. And I remember saying that to someone in the Dutch ministry who was responsible for protecting biodiversity in the sea. And we were telling him about our findings about what we had found in the sea, because I've also done work there in the marine environment. And the thing that he thought was the most amazing about this meeting was that it was crossing the placenta. And that's another thing. He said, yeah, I'm a dad too. And this disturbs me that my babies were exposed in the womb, maybe, because this is theoretically plausible. So it's definitely a concern that, you know, if something is in the blood, it could be passed to unborn babies. We know there's a lot of other chemicals that are present mm-hmm. in umbilical cord blood. Mm. So that would be a very interesting kind of sample to look at as well.
Well, Heather Leslie, who established the microplastics lab at the Free University of Amsterdam, stand by for a moment. And Erica Serino, author of Thicker Than Water, hang on here for just a second. A lot more to talk about regarding this new frontier of studies regarding plastics and human health. So we'll get to it when we come back. This is On Point.
Did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair, a new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Somebody should be in jail for murdering my sister.
A woman who's never been believed.
As long as they think I have done this, then they're not looking for who actually did this.
And that's what makes it a cold case.
No, it's a botched case.
And a search for the truth, once and for all.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Be careful. You're digging in a place that's been very peaceful for a while.
Do it anyway. Dig.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and today we're talking about the new research that has found micro and nanoplastics in living human bodies, in the bloodstream and deep in lung tissue as well. And just before the break, we were talking about how there is some evidence, at least early evidence, that these microplastics could potentially cross the placental barrier. Well, Manasa Mandravani is a pediatrician who specializes in endocrinology, and she says infants and young children do live in a world of plastic even before they're born.
It starts in pregnancy. And so mom's exposure, we do see that there is crossing into the fetal circulation. So it kind of starts there. But if you think about how a child, a baby in particular, explores the world, it's through their mouth. And so all the products that are available for children is truly made of plastic. And so they touch something, they may ingest something, they may be taking those toys, putting in their mouth, ingesting it. And even more commonly, most dishes for kids are made of plastic.
Dr. Mandravani says, though, don't panic about your children and plastic, because there are practical steps that you can take.
Some of the things that parents who are listening can do: switch out plastic that you're currently using to store and serve food with safer materials like glass and stainless steel. So replace that Tupperware with glass or stainless steel. Replace those plastic dishes with glass or stainless steel. If you have to use plastic, please try not to put those in the dishwasher or in the microwave, and do not use them past the time that you see etching and scratching. Try to always choose organic, natural fibers. So instead of using plastic for your clothes, for your baby's clothes, or for the crib sheets, try to choose materials that are organic and natural, like linen and cotton instead.
Well, I'm joined today by Erica Serino. She's author of Thicker Than Water, The Quest for Solutions to the Plastic Crisis. She's also with the Plastic Pollution Coalition as well. Heather Leslie is with us. She established the Microplastics Lab at the Free University of Amsterdam and is the lead author of a new study which found evidence of micro and nanoplastics in human blood. And by the way, we have a link to both Erica and Heather's work at onpointradio.org. Now, Erica and Heather, just hang on here for a little bit, because we really did want to get a sense about, you know, all the places expected and unexpected that we do find evidence of nano and microplastics in human environments. And so here's another one.
Once you start on this road and you start seeing plastic, you notice it everywhere. The fact that this material is such an integral part of our landscape now, its ubiquity almost renders it invisible. Suddenly, when you take the blinders off, you see it everywhere, right?
Mary Kosuth is getting her PhD at the University of Minnesota School of Public Health, and she's researching micro and nanoplastics in the Great Lakes area. Back in 2013, a scientist trawled the surface of three of the five Great Lakes, like Huron, Erie, and Superior, and sure enough, found that there were some 43,000 particles of microplastics per square kilometer. So what about the living organisms in those waters?
The natural thought process, of course, is after you find it in the environment of these organisms, then you would look at the organisms themselves to find out if these contaminants are in there. So they were found in the flesh of minnows in the Great Lakes.
Found in the minnows' flesh. So Mary and her colleagues looked at local breweries that use water from the Great Lakes to make their beer.
By 2016, there were a couple global studies that looked at microplastics in table salt and beer. Those were in China and Germany, respectively. And so here in Minnesota, we were interested in examining the Great Lakes. So we decided to look at 12 different brands of beer that draw their water from the Great Lakes. And we found virtually all of the beer samples that we tested were positive for microplastics.
Those microplastics were mainly microfibers. Now, it turns out that the clothes we wear, as we discussed earlier, with that Erica pointed out, are key culprits. One study showed that in just 20 minutes of normal activity, like walking, fleece jackets and other synthetic clothing may shed some 400 fibers per gram. That's 400 fibers per gram of, say, a fleece jacket, not per the entire jacket, which is really breaking my heart because I literally wear some kind of fleece product every single day. But back to the beer. Where did the microplastics that Mary and her team found in the beer, where did they come from? Was it directly the water itself from the Great Lakes, or was it from inside their breweries, the plastic bags where they're stored, where they stored the hops, bottle caps? It wasn't clear.
We decided to send water testing kits to the municipalities where the source water was drawn. And we did find microplastics in a lot of these tap water samples.
Okay, so the point there being that Mary looked upstream outside the brewery and to the water that was coming into the brewery and found some microplastics in those samples. Well, now that those blinders that we might have about the ubiquity of microplastics, maybe they're coming off, Mary also has a lot more studies in the works.
Wastewater treatment plants. We're doing some testing there. There's a great deal of the microplastics that actually don't make it into the effluent that comes out of the wastewater treatment plants. It actually settles into the sludge. And some of that stuff can be applied to agricultural land, which then reintroduces these particles back into the environment. And they either get into back into the water just through runoff, or else they can be whipped up by wind and carried into the air. We're also continuing to do a little bit of work on consumer products because that is the ultimate source.
Well, that's Mary Kosuth, a PhD student at the University of Minnesota School of Public Health, who's been looking into microplastics and nanoplastics in the Great Lakes. Heather Leslie, I want to explore a little bit more. We're talking about the micro and nanoplastics sort of generically, but both of you have pointed out something important, that it's not just the micro or nano polymer chains. It's the chemicals that are also part of the plastics that perhaps we should have greater concern for. And Erica had mentioned what some of those chemicals are. Heather, you've called them sort of the sauce that the spaghetti of the microplastics are in. Yes. I think you know, basic physics says that the smaller an object, right, and you have many more of those small objects, you effectively have a much greater surface area, right, with those that massive number of small objects. I mean, does this mean that the micro and nanoplastics, by virtue of being so ubiquitous and so tiny, are making it easier for these chemicals to circulate or be absorbed in the human body?
Yeah, any organic matter has a sort of affinity for other chemicals, like we mentioned, that are used as plastic additives. A lot of them are organic chemicals too, and so they like to be around plastic, you know, and they really don't dissolve that well in water. So if they have a choice, they like to stick to plastic. It's a very, very complex choreography you have there for these chemicals. Do I want to be in water? There's always going to be a little bit, and or should I be stuck to the plastic? And the problem is when they release from the plastic. So in that case, they can interact with receptors on cells and cause their toxicity that way. So in a way, you can sequester those chemicals on a piece of plastic, but you can also use it as a delivery system. And that just depends on concentration gradients, whether it's going to be released or it's going to be absorbed to the plastic. So it's very complicated.
And so these are questions that these are next step questions that need to be answered, is what you're saying.
Well, in fact, you know, my whole PhD, which is almost 20 years ago now, was dedicated to this. So it was sort of like a nice introduction to the whole world of plastic for me, because I really understood how organic chemicals will sorb and desorb, so stick and unstick to plastic. And I worked on two different types of plastic to really understand with what, you know, what amounts will end up in different places. And what you can expect in terms of the time it takes to get loaded up or to unload the chemicals. So that's pretty well modeled already.
Okay, so then forgive the interruption here, but help me understand. Mm-hmm. Let me just ask it simply then. Given that some of this is modeled, is a chemical like BPA that Erica mentioned earlier, is it more likely to be absorbed into the human body through microplastics then?
That's certainly one of the routes, but it's not the only route, because it can desorb from packaging right into food or drinks that you're consuming. And so there are many different exposure routes, and really it's a very nerdy thing to want to figure out, okay, so how much percentage is coming from all these different sources? It's a very complex story.
Yeah. We embrace nerdiness, by the way, Heather. And in fact, I mean,
me too.
But that's a fundamental question that I think is worthy of answering, because if we're going to talk about solutions, which we'll at least begin to explore in a minute or two here, we need to understand the exact extent of the problem. Now, Erica Serino, we've got a comment that's coming here from Renee Shapiro, who says, any biological effects on animals will be the same for us. We thought pesticides would only be toxic to insects, but our neurotransmitters are also vulnerable. So, too, it's likely that the toxicity of plastics will be the same in humans as seen in marine animals. What do you think about that?
We're, too, not immune to the effects of plastic, and many of the effects will be similar. I mean, we are different from, say, like a whale or a sea turtle, but there are other creatures to which we are more similar, and we could even share the same kind of physical symptoms from it. Another thing I wanted to note, too, is that, wildlife, they don't have the context to deal with plastic. And I've worked as a wildlife rehabilitator. And, you know, in addition to the chemical effects and the effects of pollution and entanglements, animals that do get entangled or exposed to plastic in some ways and then escape it are often left with long-lasting psychological trauma, and scientists have documented that in animals like whales. So we're talking about, you know, a whole suite of issues from the chemical to the physical and mental here when we talk about plastic.
Mm. Well, so regarding our new knowledge now about the presence of micro and nanoplastics in human bodies, living human bodies, Heather, I wonder what you think about this, because I was kind of charting this over in my head this morning, that you know, as Erica so aptly described to us, these plastics have been in use for, you know, intensely by human beings for more than 70 years now. And, you know, through that time, the human lifespan on average has actually continued to grow. It's continued to go up. So I'm wondering, you know, for those of us who are not newborns, you know, maybe we shouldn't worry all that much about knowing now that there's microplastics or nanoplastics in our blood, because there doesn't seem to be evidence, at least thus far, that the ubiquity of plastics has had a negative effect on human health. What do you think about that?
Yeah, well, I never advocate for worrying and fear. That's really not healthy at all. But I do advocate for responsibility. And when we see some, you know, plausibility that there's exposure in our bloodstreams, reaching organs, then I think we really should be getting to the bottom of the question of how bad is that. Mm-hmm. On the one hand, I can say I think it has nothing to do with human dignity to have plastic contamination in our bodies. I prefer to be 100% biological, and wouldn't you? But I think, you know, we are starting to learn, and this is just one shred of the whole evidence of problems in the sea with resource efficiency, with entanglement, just with quality of life, just with aesthetics. I could go on and on. Mm-hmm. You can say that plastics has been the design choice, that's very easy design choice, even for artists to use instead of working with difficult things like marble. I don't know. But it turns out that we can call it a design error, and in fact, also a market failure. This is a perfect example of that, and it requires some kind of intervention. Mm. And one of the things you can do is something on an individual level, like making choices in your own kitchen or in your own wardrobe. But you can also think about you have a power of using your voice collectively in society.
Yeah. Well, we just have 2 minutes left here, but Heather, I had one brief question to you because it's been lingering on our listener question list here. Someone wants to know, are we inhaling micro or nanoplastics from masks that we're wearing?
Of course we are. These are plastic synthetic textiles that we're putting in front of our faces. And I prefer not to wear a mask myself because I think that's just a way to increase our inhalation. And we weren't wearing masks in Amsterdam at the time we were taking the blood sample. So I think it will be interesting to see what we can find next in people who have been wearing masks, particularly prior to sampling.
Well, so Erica, we have about a minute and a half left here. And my last thought is that, first of all, we can't find a solution yet. It's just too early in our understanding of plastics in the body to say what are the solutions other than reducing the amount of plastic that we use. And, you know, I actually see plastics as a market success. They are ubiquitous because they're practically a miracle material, right? Synthetic polymers, they can do anything we want practically. They're not that hard to make. They have made a lot of things that were previously not possible possible. Human beings use them a lot because they're an incredible material. So I don't see that changing in the near future. But like, what can we do to keep using the positive aspects of polymers while reducing the negative aspects of these sort of unintended consequences of them?
Ooh, that's the million-dollar question, isn't it?
And I'm giving you 30 seconds to answer it, Erica.
All right. I would say that we have to, as individuals, make changes in our daily lives to minimize our plastic use, because the real solution to the plastic crisis is turning off the tap. And we have to face that hard truth if we want to really seriously confront this issue.
So reducing the demand for the material, you're saying?
Requiring that industries take full accountability for the mess they've created.
Well, Erica Serino, author of Thicker Than Water, The Quest for Solutions to the Plastic Crisis. She's also with the Plastic Pollution Coalition. Thank you so much for joining us today, Erica.
Thank you. Take care.
And Heather Leslie, established the microplastics lab at the Free University of Amsterdam and lead author of a new study which found micro and nanoplastics in human blood. Heather, thank you for joining us on the show, and thank you so much for your research as well.
Thank you for having me.
And by the way, we have links to both Erica and Heather's work at onpointradio.org. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes featuring Susan Fournier, Alan Questrom Professor, and Dean.
So let's start this conversation with the title of the show, Is Business Broken? It's a provocative title and a question. Where did this come from? Why that question now?
We're in a big cultural moment where capitalism, business, market systems are really being scrutinized and debated, and the role of business with it. So I think the question is just on the table. It's on people's minds. It's in the news media. It's in conversations. I think there are growing voices, loud voices, especially among young people who seem increasingly to believe that business and maybe capitalism with it are harmful and create rather than solve problems for society. And what we do seem to hear are those loud voices, and they are very black and white. There are protagonists and the antagonists and the pros and the cons, and there's really no middle discussion. It's sort of like people for and against, and it's loud.
Right. For and against DEI, for instance, right? A battle at play.
Right.
The way you describe it and the way you describe the polarization, it makes it feel like very much of the digital age, right? It feels very much of today. Some of those arguments have been around, though, right? Is this criticism of business and this question, is business broken, is that a new question?
You are so right. It is not a new question. Schumpeter, he was a professor at Harvard, and he's also maybe one of the most influential political economists of the early 20th century. He called for the death of capitalism, the death of business, 100 years ago.
Okay. Wow.
And when he critiqued way back then, he said the very successes of capitalism would bring about its downfall because it would create values hostile to capitalism, and that this would particularly take hold among intellectuals who were critiquing. So there's a lot of that same kind of dynamic happening today, and that's 100 years old. But yeah, we've seen this kind of cultural fervor playbook many times in the past, often precipitated by big crises.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.